and welcome to a very special episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Monson. And when I say very special, I mean it, both because of the very special guest I'm about to introduce joining Capitol Record for his second time, but also because of the event that it is connected to. Today, we are out at the Reagan Library, where tonight National Review is hosting its annual William F. Buckley Gala. And we will be presenting the annual William F. Buckley Prize for Leadership in Political Thought to today's Capitol Record guest. He is one of my dearest pals, my mentors, my heroes, and particularly in this cause of Capitol Record, which is the defense of free enterprise, the greatest path to prosperity the world's ever known, as he himself has uttered so many times on airwaves. And of course, I'm referring to none other than the anchor of the number one show on all business television, Larry Kudlow. Larry, welcome back to Capitol Record.
Thank you, David. You're wonderful. I appreciate this very, very much. Thank you for that great intro.
So our seats are kind of reversed today. You know, normally you're interviewing me on air, and I get to do it with you. A few weeks ago, you let me play anchor on your radio show, but you weren't the guest though. But I thought that went pretty well. That was fun.
Doing radio is fabulous stuff, really fabulous stuff. And this will not be the last time that you anchor my show.
Well, I'll look forward to it. I'll tell you, it's harder being an anchor than it is being a guest. a lot of time to fill and you know, commentary to offer and all that kind of stuff. Hey, Larry, before we kind of get into talking about National Review and Bill Buckley, and I'm really excited for the event that is going to be taking place in your honor. But, you know, this is a podcast about the economy, about free enterprise, about capital markets. We're in a tough time in financial markets. You talk about it on the show every day. The bulk of your career through two presidential administrations and multiple decades in public life, whether it be on Wall Street or in media or in the White House or in the Fed, for that matter. A lot of people don't talk about your humble beginnings there as an economist at the Federal Reserve. But there's been such a focus on the nexus in public policy, politics, and money, economics, finance. What do you think right now are the biggest things? I mean, there's 100 criticisms you and I could offer the Biden administration. What are the biggest things you think are going wrong in economic policy?
Well, I think the problem here is that you've got three Democratic-run houses, White House, Senate, and the House of Representatives. And I think they're just kind of running away toward a socialist approach, big government, heavy regulatory planning, taxing, spending. Of course, the fossil fuel story, they turned the spigot off. And I don't think this is what the country had in mind when they elected Joe Biden, who tried to run as a moderate. But in any event, what they've done is they've taken a pretty healthy economy, recovering from COVID. They basically inherited a boom with low inflation and very moderate energy prices. And because of policy mistakes, as I say, massive overspending, massive overregulation, $200 billion worth of regulation in their first year. That's a world record. Recently, higher taxes on businesses, their obsession with global warming, which I think they're making a big mistake. Anyway, they've taken a boom and they've turned it into a bust. And they've taken low inflation and they've turned it into high inflation, which I fear is embedded in the economy and will be difficult to vanquish. So the way I see it, the challenges here are going to be to bring the inflation rate down, to keep the dollar strong. The Fed is actually finally moving in the right direction And that's good. We're seeing some signs of this with a strong dollar and softer commodity prices. But I don't think it's going to be easy. And another problem is that the fiscal policies of the administration and Congress are spending more in recent legislation, which itself is inflationary. And the Fed, therefore, may have to be even tighter than they'd like to be or any of us would like them to be. And I think the recession risk is very significant, and interest rate risks and stock market risks. So, you know, it's not a great picture. You and I are optimists. I still am an optimist in the longer term. But this drift toward socialism, as Kevin Hassett would say in his great book, and we're actually having a Fox Nation special on this tomorrow. This drift toward socialism has to be checked, David. It has to be checked to get us back on the free enterprise, free market path. And then the economy can boom again and we can get rid of this inflation. The elections obviously are going to be very important here.
So, Larry, we had a pretty, you know, traditional Keynesian in Larry Summers, who was one of Obama's economic advisors. And we were coming out of financial crisis, and they were prescribing in typical Keynesian fashion a kind of countercyclical fiscal punch, a big government spending. Look, George W. had some Keynesians advising him, and they tried on a couple occasions big, you know, government spending and a Keynesian objective. The Biden administration has upped the ante on spending, but they were doing it at a point of a real strong economic recovery. We were in a V shape coming out of the COVID shutdowns. There was very low and declining unemployment. There were rising wages. There was low inflation, as you say. So this wasn't Keynesian. Is that why you and Hazard and some of others are referring to this as a tide towards socialism? Because they're not driven by traditional Keynesian thought of trying to stimulate the economy, are they? They're just simply trying to grow the role of government.
Yes, I think that's fair. You know, and back in 2020, I don't know, from the middle of that year on until the end of the administration, I argued strenuously that we were in a V-shaped recovery. And COVID, you know, came through like a natural disaster, you know, a terrible hurricane, but the economy was fundamentally sound and it was booming. So all this Keynesian stimulus was unnecessary. But I think a deeper problem, David, probably illustrated by the shutdown of fossil fuels with respect to permitting that would allow, you know, drilling and fracking, that you could build new refiners, improve the LNG terminal. This is a exercise in regulatory-driven central planning, almost jamming it down our throats. And that's why this is different than the more, you're right, the more Keynesian, traditional Keynesian view of a Larry Summers or a Jason Furman. And those guys, to their credit, have objected to how the Biden administration is operating. I mean, I've never seen a regulatory assault, and it's not just on fossils. It's on businesses, large and small, and their attempt at unionization, which is very important. They're going after companies everywhere, National Labor Relations Board actually working with union organizers, Federal Trade Commission trying to break up companies, stop mergers and acquisitions, you know, the SEC resorting to environmental regulations, very stringent, complicated, costly regulations. That's not part of their mission, was never legislated by any congressional laws. It's another example that just recently, in the last day or two, we've seen a denial of leasing and permitting in New Mexico, northern New Mexico. And the Interior Secretary used two reasons. She said it doesn't pass environmental inspection. And secondly, it would disrupt the Native American reservations and parklands. And the Native Americans who live up there are furious. They're saying, no, wait a minute. We want drilling because it creates jobs and we get royalties, which allow us to, support our reservation. I mean, it just goes beyond belief. And no matter what their occasional rhetoric is, they are using these regulatory planning to stop business and to stop enterprise. Roads and highways and bridges, they've spent a fortune on that. They got the appropriation. And again, the environmental radicalism is stopping everything. So I think that is the drift towards socialism. You know, our friend, our mutual friend, the great Steve Forbes, argued many months ago on our program that modern socialism does no longer use, taking over the means of production, buying steel mills and factories and, a Joe Stalin type approach. Modern socialism is done through the regulatory state. That's where the central planning comes in. And that's where the drift to socialism comes in. And the economy is stalled out. It's like it lacks oxygen. It's the blood is not flowing through the veins because of all these regulatory disruptions. So that's my biggest concern. I mean, you and I know the Fed can beat inflation, but the problem is they may have to beat everything else into the ground or underground. And that's too bad because supply side policies would reawaken the economy, lower tax and regulatory burdens, stop this crazy spending. That's what we need. We need to grow the economy. We need to work more, produce more, invest more, and we need to provide the incentives to do so. Incentives matter. The incentive model of growth would solve this problem, but that, unfortunately, is a theory that is rejected by the Joe Biden's Washington.
I think it's worth pausing right now because I have one of the great supply sider contemporaries, on the podcast right now. I talk about this all the time, Larry, from a matter of basic economic understanding, that people associate the brand of supply side economics with lower tax rates. And I think as a policy prescription, that's often correct. We like lower taxes on investment, lower taxes on income, bringing down marginal rates, lower taxes on productivity. And yet, the thing you just said is why we want that. Ultimately, at the heart of supply-side economics is the belief in incentives. And what we're trying to incent is growth, is productivity. And this is the frustration I have right now with this regulatory apparatus, with the notion of an increasingly larger government as a percentage of economic output, and also with the idea that the way to control inflation is to destroy jobs and to destroy growth, that if you get less goods and services, then you meet demand, and so you can kind of grow by shrinking. I think all that goes against the heart of supply-side economics, but more importantly, goes against what you guys proved in history, that you can control inflation and create economic growth by getting incentives right. So it isn't just the policy issue of what we'd like to see right now. It's the philosophy of economics that we believe in, that incentives matter for growth.
Yeah, growth through limited government or lower tax rates or minimal regulations, with the steady dollar, is a prescription that has worked throughout history. I wrote about this in my book, JFK and the Reagan Revolution. But every time we cut tax rates, whether it was JFK or Reagan or Trump, what we saw was high growth and low inflation. And every time we resort back to the heavy hand of government that raises taxes and regulations or cheapens the dollar, you know, what we see is stagflation. So history proves which direction is right and which direction is wrong. Right now, we're stuck in the wrong direction. And I think the point here is incentives matter. You know, Art Laffer always says this: if you tax something more, you get less of it. But if you tax something less, you get more of it. And that is the incentive model of growth. And it applies to working. It applies to investing. It applies to risk taking. It applies throughout the economy. I mean, I want to see more people working. Right now, these spending policies, these subsidies, constant increasing of subsidies, so without any work requirements. I mean, I have Senator Phil Graham coming on the show. He just finished a book about this subject. The lack of work requirements, workfare as it's called, is one of the most insidious things. You know, the bottom 20% of the economy, the bottom 20% of the workforce doesn't work anymore. And they don't work because we are paying them generously. But even though somebody like myself, look, I learned this from Reagan. You know, we suffered a bad recession with inflation in the early 80s. I'm all for the safety net. America is a generous country. And we need to have assistance when people are badly in need. But that should not be a permanent condition. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is the safety net and the assistance, whether it's welfare, food stamps, housing subsidies, child care, health care, the lack of workfare, the lack of work requirements has made a permanent condition where I think Senator Graham notes something like, or actually it might have been Fred Smith, the chairman of FedEx, was on the program. Something in the bottom quintile, David, the bottom 20% of the economy, only 36% of the people are working. Only 36% are working. Why? Because they have enough assistance programs up to $100,000 for a family, household, two-earner household with two kids. Up $100,000 of government assistance with no work requirements attached to it. I mean, that's a staggering number. That goes way beyond the safety net. That's a socialist vision where government is the employer and government is the producer and government is the ultimate central planner. And Biden's Washington believes this, but it has to be overturned. If we're going to go back to prosperity, we have to go back to the free market, free enterprise model and provide incentives, not subsidies.
You know, another historical validation of what you're saying specific to this subject of workfare, and you and I are both pretty fair politically. If a Democrat does something well, you're going to say it. And if a Republican does something poorly, you're going to say it. But Bill Clinton, with Newt Gingrich in the House, Bill Clinton signed workfare requirements into welfare reform. And, you know, Larry, I do a daily market commentary called the DCtoday.com, and I have a section called Against Doomsdayism every day because I get tired of all the doomsday talk. But you know that single mothers before Bill Clinton signed a work requirement and welfare reform, that the amount of single mothers who were able to find work or were choosing to find work was 65% in the early 90s, mid 90s, and it's over 80% today. And that with that, child poverty, extreme child poverty dropped by 60%. this is something that has historically been proven to work. It not only adds to the dignity of the people involved, but economically, it's pro-growth. It gets people useful, feeling productive in society. It adds to their economic well-being. And because we're talking often about the lower income rung, you're talking about children. You're talking about poor families. And so I cannot even comprehend people opposing what has been proven out of Democrat policies. This isn't partisan. Proven in both types of administrations to work. And so I think that you're right to be adding to the list of hobby horses of us supply-siders, not just tax rates, not just regulation, not just energy, but a work requirement into our public support programs.
Listen, back then in the mid-90s, I had nothing but praise for Bill Clinton for working with Newt Gingrich and the GOP Congress for these welfare reforms. It was one of the great policy achievements, and it worked. It worked beautifully. Literally, people went back to work, and the volume of government subsidies went way down. So it's funny. I know Bill Clinton. I've known him a very, very, very long time. Kate, I would see him here in New York City sometimes, and I'd tell him what a great job. And then I say, you know, Bill, you were kind of like Ronald Reagan's third term. And depending on his mood, he'd either smile or not.
Yeah.
But I mean, I actually have a good history with Bill Clinton. So you're right. This doesn't have to be partisan. But unfortunately, the Biden group today does not have that vision. They don't have that vision. And you see, it's interesting. You mentioned Larry Summers. I would add to that my friend, a good friend, Jason Furman. They worked in the Clinton years. They cut their teeth in government policy during the Clinton years, not the most recent years. And that's why they're so critical of what's going on. Look, the work requirements were scrapped during the COVID emergency spending. And at the time, I thought that was a mistake. And by the way, so did my boss, Donald Trump, who was very keen on workfare. But the idea was it was just temporary. And what's happened, starting with the spending bill of March 2021, the lack of workfare has become permanent. The Democrats have taken that out of every spending bill in the last 2 years. So that's a big problem. And if you have a change in Congress, I think one of the first things to be done is to restore workfare. And I think it would make a huge difference. And I think the GOP on this point is pretty united on that view. I mean, I've interviewed, I've interviewed practically everybody in the leadership on down. And I always ask this question. And so, yes, alongside taxes and regulations, workfare is absolutely essential.
So, Larry, one of the things that I have read from you over the years, I think is relevant to this topic, because it's not merely about the policy efficacy, how it can help promote growth, it can get people working, help with wages, all these things that matter. But you did an episode with Bill Buckley on Firing Line in the second half of the 1990s, and you talked about the morality of capitalism. You wrote a little book about the virtues of markets. I think that if we're going to be successful in making the case you're talking about, there's Republican support right now as a policy matter, but I really believe we have to make the argument not merely on the basis of economic considerations, but also the virtue of work, the dignity of mankind, being productive, being useful, not becoming a ward of the state, not becoming a ward of others. Can you talk a little bit about how your views of the moral case for Free Enterprise has influenced you over the years?
I think the things you said are absolutely correct. Look, just by itself, in a moral sense, in a spiritual sense, really, work is godly, and work gives men and women dignity. You know, the best work I've ever seen on this was done by Arthur Brooks, who ran the AEI for many years, who wrote on this point. I once had a one-hour interview with Arthur in front of 300 or 400 people at National Review. This goes back a ways, but really this was the topic. And he did all this longitudinal analysis where he literally interviewed and looked at data for tens and tens of thousands of people, and he surveyed them. And it turns out that people who are working for a living, who are working, are much happier than people who are living on government subsidies. Much happier. By their own admission, there is no dignity for government subsidies, the government dole. There's no inherent virtue in it. It doesn't make people feel better. They do it, but it doesn't make them feel better. And it wasn't about income levels. It didn't matter whether you were rich or middle or lower middle or whatever. Folks who work are happier. So I've always felt that, you know, there's some ingrained idea, ingrained sense inside folks that literally they're doing the Lord's work, that they're making a contribution to their kids, to their families, to their business, to their communities. They're important. And that's the dignity of it. And I think we've lost that in recent years. I think we've lost that sense of the dignity and morality and contribution and service of working. You know, by itself, work is a virtue. And that idea is central to the American way of life, to the American ideal itself. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Work is essential. It is critical to fulfilling that mission. And we've lost that. We've seen people on the left talk about, oh, let's give people money so they can go off and be free to pursue their hobbies. They can become artists. They can spend their time at, you know, the beach and this and that. It's crazy stuff. Demeaning work. And you can't do that. A healthy society has its people working. And by the way, I think that's spread. You know, people working are law-abiding. Crime rates go down. Local communities improve if you're working, but they deteriorate if you're out of work or living on the dole. I mean, I could go on and on about this. But I just think the dignity of work, you're literally doing the Lord's work and not the devil's. And I just think that needs to be communicated again and again, just that idea itself. It's not about rich or poor. It's not about class warfare. You know, it's not about equity or social justice. It's a basic fundamental tenet of the American soul. And we need to revive that, David. We need to revive that.
So, Larry, you're hitting on the point that is kind of what I believe God put me on earth to advocate. This is an economic and spiritual point both that has to be synthesized. And I would just add to the beautiful comments you just uttered that I think it's at the heart of what it means to be a supply-sider, to be a defender of free enterprise. It is not merely that I think we get a more efficient and more prosperous and more productive economy with incentives and policy. a focus on the production of goods and services, but I think it is more in line with how God made us to be. Where Keynesianism not only struggles with a central planning problem, with excessive government spending and indebtedness problem, but it starts with the belief that mankind is fundamentally a consumer. And I believe, as you just said, that mankind is fundamentally a worker. And that is both an economic and spiritual principle that we have to continue to juxtapose.
You know, moral case goes hand in hand with the supply side case. So think of it this way. I'm never quite sure what my life's mission is, but I will say this. In terms of economic policy, let's make it easier and more profitable to work. let's do the best we can to generate the opportunities and the incentives to work. And then just let folks be themselves. Give them the freedom to work and remove the barriers to work. And we'll have a much stronger society, and we'll also have a much stronger economy, and we'll also have a happier country. Right now, the country's not happy, and I want happy. You and I mean, we try to be as happy as we can, and that's a wonderful thing. And also, look, David, I would take it, you know, I go off here into the wild blue yonder, but frankly, I think, you know, we both mentioned God here. You know, I think religion plays a role in this. I myself am a Catholic convert 25 years ago, a little more than that. I bemoan the fact that religion has been diminished. And by the way, this is a part of this Biden world in Washington, too. And these people, crazy people on the left, they don't like God. They don't like religion. They don't like anything to do with that. But I think religion, and I'm Protestants, Catholics, Jews. I think more people should go to church. More people should go to temple. More people should listen to what's in the Bible. New Testament, Old Testament, there are important lessons in there for us, how to live, how to behave, and how to work, why work is important. You know, it's service, contributions, service. To lapse back into economics, Jean-Baptiste say, he may be the first supply sider, I don't know, he lived in the early 1800s in France. I think he's the best thing France ever produced. He argued that supply creates its own demand. And I would say that, you know, people who work create supplies, you know, workers creating goods and services. And then that creates the income and that creates the consumption and that creates a healthy society and a healthy economy. So
and it creates cooperation because we don't produce goods and services unless they're meeting the needs of humanity. And so all at once, the profit motive driving the production of goods and services is forcing us to compete, to be attractive to others, to get along. And so you get this entire sense of social organization that socialism and central planning work against. And it's funny because what you just said is so powerful that we're everyone's sitting around wondering, what do we do about this divisiveness, this polarization, this tribalization? People are not happy, but they're also angry at one another. There's too much fighting about politics. There is too much opioid epidemic. There's too much desperation. All these things that you and I find horrifying. And I think so much of it, not all of it, not it's not utopian, but so much of it gets solved for with a healthy restoration of the Judeo-Christian value system and a repurposing of one's life around productive work.
Yes, yes. Years ago, I wrote a column. I can't remember all these columns, but If you go to church or temple on Saturday and Sunday, you're going to do better in the stock market on Monday. Yeah. I don't mean to be so glib, but that's kind of the point that I'm trying to make. Anyway, I think that religion is a good thing, not a bad thing. I think we can learn a lot from the big book, from the Lord's big book, from the Bible. Actually, you can learn a lot from our big book too. But the point is, values, good values lead to good decisions. And some of that, not all of it, because America is a great country. And there's, you know, it's 160 million people that do go to work every day. And we want to get more, but we've lost some of that religious thinking or spiritual thinking. And it's not good. It's not good. The other point you're making, you know, civility is a lost art. And that is most unfortunate. The ability to disagree with somebody in a polite, respectful way has deteriorated enormously in our culture. Yes, you see it in politics, but I think you see it just in civil life. And the communal cooperation has been lost. What de Tocqueville so admired, looking at America in the middle of the 19th century, you know, the communal organizations, the fraternal organizations, and that does include churches and temples and so forth. But we've lost a lot of that. I should be able to have a conversation. Let's go back to economic policy and politics. I don't like name calling. What I do like is the use of facts, history, but I like to respect the other side and try to bring them along. And I think we all can learn. There's no monopoly on learning. You know, there are teachable moments out there, but not if we're screaming at each other. I mean, I've said this many times, Dave. This is a sidelight, but like, I want to take Joe Biden. I know Joe Biden. I have known him for a long time. He appeared on my old TV show on CNBC many, many times. And I knew him personally, and I liked him. He was a man of good humor, old-style guy, and politically kind of a moderate Democrat, sort of. Most of a moderate liberal. Anyway, at the beginning of his administration, when I went back, when I left Washington and came back to broadcasting, I hated the word lie. I said, "Presidents, it's disrespectful." I used the term cognitive dissonance, which is, you know, a sort of glib way, but I just didn't. But here's where I am, that Joe Biden now, in all these interviews, is just plain not telling the truth. It's just not telling the truth. And some of his senior staff likewise. And I just hate that. I mean, the other night I did my opening riff and I literally apologized for calling him a liar. But I don't know how else to do it. Facts are facts. And you cannot, I mean, it's a very totalitarian, authoritarian approach to politics. This was used by dictators down through the years. I'm not saying Joe Biden's a dictator, but the style is authoritarian, totalitarian, to try to say that white is black and black is white, and what you see with your own eyes is not right. That's what dictators do. And we're getting a sniff of that right now. And I don't like it one bit. You know, just tell the truth. And by the way, if the president makes a mistake and he changes, the public loves him for it. To say, you know what, we tried this and it didn't work. So now we're going to try something else. And by the way, I'll go back to your Bill Clinton point. That is exactly what Bill Clinton did. When he was, you know, he ran as a Southern governor who was a moderate, who could speak to all the groups, labor, business, and so forth, blacks, whites, you know, he went to church, all this. And his first couple of years in office, he ran as a Southern, he started providing all these big government policies. And he got clobbered in the midterm election. So what did he do? He apologized. He changed. He gives a State of the Union, says the era of big government is over. And the next thing you know, he's making a deal, an unbelievably important welfare reform deal with Newt Gingrich. He's cutting the capital gains tax, et cetera, et cetera. And the economy starts booming. And the stock market starts booming. And the unemployment rate keeps falling with no inflation. No inflation. Working folks and producing folks do not create inflation. I just would love, and I would praise Joe Biden if he would do that sort of thing. I just would praise that. You know, reset. You've gone too far. And, you know, stop calling people fascists and all this stuff. Stop that. That is not healthy. And it's the same whether you and I are talking. Look, you and I have had, we've had disagreements about, okay, that's fine. We can talk about it. One of the things I learned from Bill Buckley was how to use self-deprecating humor and being clever and being calm and being civil. Now, Bill Buckley was a model for how to conduct yourself in public life. Ronald Reagan was a model of how to conduct yourself in public life. And by the way, although I did not know Reagan that well, I knew Bill Buckley very well. He and Pat were personal friends. My God, they took care of me and Judy for years in our worst moments. Bill Buckley taught me how to be civil. Sitting around, I can't tell you how many dinners we had up in Connecticut or here in New York with a Henry Kissinger, for example, and arguing around the table with humor and respect and some self-deprecation. You know, those are wonderful models and values, and we've lost that for some reason. We've lost that, and we have to regain it. And when I come out to California and accept this wonderful honor that you and the NR are bestowing on me, which I'm not sure I really deserve. But when I do that, I want to talk about Bill Buckley. Yes, Bill Buckley believed in freedom and free markets and capitalism, and he was a great anti-communist. And he, you know, believed in, and he was a religious man. He went to church. He was a high church Catholic. But Bill Buckley taught us on his television shows and in person, how to conduct civil discussions or disagreements. That is a lost art. He taught me that at a time in my life when I needed somebody to give me direction and guidance on how to live. And he was essential to that, essential to that. As much as his brilliance and his devotion to freedom and America, that's what I learned from Bill Buckley. I mean, I can remember at parties, these beautiful parties he would hold, especially the ones out in his old place in Connecticut on the water on the Long Island Sound. Bill Buckley would take my wife by his hand and sit her down by the piano. He was a brilliant piano player. My wife, she's pretty good. I mean, she taught piano when she was younger. And they would play duets in front of 100 people at a dinner party. And I'm watching this, and it's unbelievable. But he did it because he loved her, and he did it because he loved us, and they invited us to everything, large and small. Pat Buckley was the same way. Every single dinner, we used to have those old NR staff dinners at his house here in New York City, and she would order me a Diet Coke. And when I finished it, she'd make me have a second Diet Coke while everybody else is, you know, drinking their heads off. And I can't tell you how wonderful that was. I mean, that I could talk about that for hours. I see it in my head, in my mind. I've never forgotten it. with my wife sitting there on the bench in front of that piano playing a duet. Imagine that. Bill Buckley. Oh, my gosh.
So, Larry, here's why you do deserve this prize. Because everything you just said about Bill's influence on you is true of your influence on me.
Oh.
I hope you know that, because I mean it.
That's a wonderful thing. That's a wonderful thing. But we're in it together. That's the key. We're in it together. And we have been for quite a while, ever since we met. And it's a wonderful thing, David. We understand each other. Friends are very important in life. Friends are very important in life. And, you know, asking for help and accepting help is very important in life. I don't care who you are, highfalutin, lowfalutin, whether I'm sitting there in my office on the second floor of the White House or whether I'm someplace in a church basement, it's the same principles, it's the same values. And I work hard to keep those values up. Nothing's perfect, but I work hard to keep those values up. It's one of the things I've learned in my long life. I'm 75 years old. My crucible was about 30 years ago, and I came through it. And all I'll say is, with respect to Bill Buckley, Bill was a central person in bringing me back to life and showing me how to be a public person and how to be into public policy or politics or government. But even as a private person, he showed me the right way to behave. And behavior is so important. We forget that. Our behavior is so important. There's a right way to do these things, and there's a wrong way to do these things. And Bill Buckley was one of the people that showed me the right way. And I am forever, forever indebted to that.
Well,
if I say that, it's the Reagan Ranch talk, you probably throw me out. But that's, I'm going to tell you here on this podcast, that's in my heart, that's the most important thing. And he did it at the worst time of my life, literally.
Well, Larry, I hope you will share it at the Reagan event. And I think that in a lot of ways, the stuff we've been talking about here today, it goes full circle. You know, the vision we have for an economic life of prosperity and growth is for a good life, a flourishing life. And if we get 5% real GDP growth, but we don't have friendship and civility, I will not right. take that trade. And I believe Buckley agreed with that, and you agree with it. And I think it's the cause of our respective lives. And by the way, you say you're 75. I want to thank you for doing your part to help with the labor participation force. Because I like 75-year-olds still going strong, my friend.
Yeah, with the Lord's help, it's never been
That's
better.
Right. That's right. Larry, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for your influence on me and so many others, the legacy of Buckley that you live out, and your public service. I can't say enough how grateful I am. And I hope everyone listening to Capitol Record realizes the encapsulation of this mission that this whole conversation with Larry today has represented. I say every single week that my cause is for a free and virtuous society. And I do not believe in the virtue sprinkled on top of the free. I believe in the two harmoniously existing together for the cause of human flourishing. There is economic growth in it, but there is also a satisfying, rewarding, joyful life in it. And Larry Kudlow, in his personal and professional life, embodies all the Capitol Record is about. And I'm honored to have had you on the podcast today, Larry.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much. You're very kind. God bless.
God bless. Hey, look, I don't have a lot to add to what I just said. I think you kind of got our closing comments with me and Larry together there. I'll just simply close up by saying that I would really love it if you would share this particular episode of Capitol Record with as many people as you want. Post on your social media, email it, forward it, whatever you feel called to do, because I really think that there's a discussion here about economic growth, about policy. He brought up John Baptiste Say as the original supply sider. It's something I've been saying for years and teaching students and trying to make the case for production-oriented economics as a moral cause. But the things that Larry was talking about today regarding the influence Bill had in his life, the friendship, the truly important moments at which community, character, these things matter. I want all of this ingrained together as the essence of Capitol Record. I think that free and robust capital markets drive the cause of freedom, prosperity, growth, healthy living. And I think that the virtuous cycle, the positive feedback loop that we most need, is when you have things like civility and friendship and virtue working hand in hand with freedom and incentives to drive a better life. The central planner wants something that can't exist. A utopia that's impossible on this side of heaven, and B, an enlightened, anointed special person who supposedly has the knowledge to drive that experience. What guys like Buckley knew, what people like Kudlow know, and what I want to use this podcast to share is that no such divinely ordained central planner exists by which they can wave the wand of stewardship of our economic affairs to create this nirvana. What can happen is those of us behaving with a spirit of character, sacrifice, friendship, virtue, in an environment of freedom, growth, incentives, and productivity, can create a greater opportunity for human flourishing. That's our cause, the cause of free and virtuous society. Very few people in my adult lifetime have embodied it more than Larry Kudlow and more than William F. Buckley. So we're going to continue to try to fill those shoes and work towards the end of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to Capitol Record.